Because I'm white.
Because he was a grunt muffin.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've been off for a couple of weeks, so I'm just looking at our website to see what is new. The last thing we talked about is was Hail Caesar. And before that, there was 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, Making a Murderer, and another Best Picture nominee, The Revenant. And I also wrote a thing about Steve Carell in the week we took off. So, yeah, you can check that out, themacguffinmen.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or any podcast app that you use. Apparently, our RSS feed goes right to them somehow that I didn't set up at all, but good for that. And yeah, now let's get to this episode and use some fair use to allow me to post a public enemy. James,
yes.
What are we talking about here today? Are we fighting the power?
I think so.
Yeah, we're always fighting the power. We're so socially concerned, you and I.
Yeah, that Mighty Ducks trilogy really made a big change.
No, exactly. Our most talked about podcast really got to the heart of, I don't know, alcoholism.
Anyway, that's not what we're talking about today.
No, it is not.
We're talking about Spotlight.
Spotlight.
And I'll apologize now. I am a little sick, so I am sorry to the listeners.
As long as you make equally sick points, then I'm sure they will forgive you.
Yeah. Don't want to dwell on it too much, but I thought I'd get it in the spotlight right away.
Well, I mean, we are talking about Spotlight, so you should put it in the spotlight immediately.
That's right. Anyone who's seen this movie knows that they say the word spotlight a lot.
Especially in the beginning. Like, it is very front heavy. Like, there's even a scene, I think it's the editorial meeting, the first editorial meeting with Marty Baron, and he starts asking, he asks Michael Keaton something about Spotlight, and Michael Keaton's like, oh yeah, Spotlight? And like, it's just like, of course, the thing you run. Like, you don't need to say it again. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, you don't Spotlight, I Spotlight.
Yes. So, Spotlight.
Yeah. Best Picture winner.
Best Picture winner.
Yeah, not like stupid Revenant.
Sure.
Yeah, Best Picture winner. Mm-hmm. A very surprising one for you, judging by your reaction.
Yes,
I
was very surprised. But like in retrospect, when I was thinking about it, I was like, I shouldn't have been that surprised. Not necessarily that Spotlight won, but just that there was like a weird winner. I mean,
why do you say that?
Because looking over the 10 nominees, and I remember even when the nominations came out, it was just sort of like this is just kind of going to be a year where it's just like, well, I guess that was the best picture. You know, like, what was I expecting? I guess it was The Revenant after actor and director, but just sort of,
I think that's what it was. But yeah, there was no kind of runaway. When is there, though?
That is a good question. I would have to, and here's also the thing about the Oscars. I don't think about the Oscars other than the 3.5 to 4 hours that I spend watching them every year, you know? So,
yeah.
I don't know. I suppose I don't haven't really put it into a historical context. Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw a lot of people suggest that the reason Spotlight did win is just the way that the voting process works, that unless one movie gets, you know, 51% of the win of people's number one choice, then they have to start counting kind of priority votes and what got a lot of people to vote second or third or fourth, and plus how many people put it in first. So,
Glenn Whip wrote a good thing in the LA Times about this, sort of breaking it all down. And it's very short and very worth reading if you're interested in these things.
Yeah, and just that this is a movie that I think a lot of people would put either first, second, or third, and not a lot of people would put it 10th. And, you know, a lot of people would hate Mad Max. A lot of people would dislike some of the things that did get nominated, whereas I think a lot of people saw this as an important movie, something that deals with something real and powerful. In some ways that I know we're going to talk about, a bit of a throwback movie to the 70s, which is a time a lot of people like to really credit as one of the better times in Hollywood. So, you know, I think it just was up there for almost everybody. And that's why it ended up being the best, you know, winning Best Picture.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And that Glenn Whip article that I was talking about, Best Picture is the only award that is awarded via that preferential system, whereas
right.
like
yeah.
Something like Best Picture, or sorry, Best Actor, Best Director, those are like people pick one name, you know? So that's how Leo and Iñárritu are able to win for The Revenant, because they had the most first place votes for that, whereas The Revenant could have conceivably had the most first place votes, but it didn't. If it didn't have over 50% of first place votes, then it doesn't necessarily win Best Picture, you know?
Yeah.
And The Revenant, I mean, for reasons that we've talked about, is the type of movie that, and as Whip points out, like, you can love that movie, you can also hate that movie. There are not a lot of people that sort of feel. I mean, that's not entirely true. I mean, we were kind of in the middle, but it's way more likely that you're going to love that movie or hate that movie as opposed to just being cool with it. Like, I think Spotlight is like a just being cool with it sort of movie, you know? Like, it's, you know, it seems like a movie you, when you're like home visiting your parents on the holidays, that you would go to see, you know, like that. It's just classic. And you think of some of the Best Picture winners in these past few years, I think I did see The King's Speech with my parents when I was home for Christmas, you know, like it's just those sorts of movies that kind of play to enough people in just the right way that are able to win, you know?
Yeah. And another stat that people talk about, with kind of the middling response to Spotlight and still winning the award, is that it's the only Best Picture to win one other Oscar since 1952. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what you thought of that, about a movie winning Best Picture and not necessarily being the best at any of these other elements that the Academy Awards.
I mean, I can't think of anything that any of the other awards that I feel like it should have won, you know? I mean, I don't even have out of those 10, I certainly don't have a clear Best Picture winner. Like, of course, Mad Max is my favorite of those 10 movies, but even I had no hopes for that, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I suppose I have no real thoughts, you know? Like, I don't even remember what the other screenplay nominations were. Oh, Ex Machina was in that category. So I certainly wasn't even rooting for Spotlight in that category, you know?
Yeah.
Cause Ex Machina is, I mean, that happens every year, that, there's that sort of one cool movie the Oscar nominates for in the screenplay category. Like, I remember the first year I realized this was Memento, you know, like where it's just like one of those popular movies with the cool kids that year, and we got to throw it some Oscar award, and it's always the screenplay award. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Ruffalo certainly shouldn't have won. And, as much as I love Rachel McAdams, and well, I guess I don't really care for Alicia Vikander. I don't know. I have no answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't do much for me in this movie.
Yeah, there's a weird thing about Rachel McAdams in this movie to me. So I shot the TIFF premiere of this movie. Like, when I say I shot it, I mean, you know, I shoot sort of the red carpet sort of deal. So I'm out in the street following Michael Keaton, like slapping the people trying to touch his hands, like some screaming Usher fans. And
you're the Canadian Iñárritu, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So all the journalists were there, all the people that Spotlight is about were there, from the journalistic standpoint, and they arrived first and were very early, and were just standing around on the red carpet, and not knowing a ton about the movie or the subject, I didn't know who each person was, and I just ended up standing next to a woman for a few minutes, just waiting for the car. And since security is pretty lax, you know, it's not like anybody was pushing me away. Security was lax because they weren't superstars, you know, like if I had done that next to Michael Keaton, I probably would have gotten punched in the dick. But, yeah, so I was just standing at her and just next to her, and she was just looking around, and naturally in these things, kind of the only thing to do is people watch, and I was sort of just watching her look around, right? And then the stars started showing up, and I had to start running around because everybody showed up at the exact same time. But anyway, so I'm watching Spotlight, and I'm watching Rachel McAdams, and I'm like, she's looking at things in an odd way. And I sort of, over the course of the movie, pieced together that the woman that I was looking at look at things was Sasha in Spotlight. Yeah. And she kind of nailed it. Like, Rachel McAdams nailed it, and I assume Mark Ruffalo nailed it as well. It's just kind of like, the way that they quote-unquote nail it is still just kind of weird and bizarre, you know? And doesn't really work for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, Mark Ruffalo's performance in this movie, I think, if this was not a movie based on a true story, you would think this performance getting nominated for an Academy Award was insane. You know?
Yeah.
Just because he's so off-putting and annoying. And, I mean, his Oscar scene is the worst. But, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of one of the only big kind of louder moments in this movie, right?
Yeah, it is. It's the only we're gonna put the camera just slightly out of the eye line of a character and have him yell opinions at it, you know?
Yeah. And do you think it's because that was so isolated, it kind of stands out as even more insufferable for you?
Yeah, I think so. But also, I mean, I can't imagine how multiple of those scenes would make it better, you know? Like, that's something that I've always kind of, that's always bothered me, you know, the award scene, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's bad, but, like, having more of it wouldn't have evened it out, you know? It would have made me dislike the movie more. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I get that. Well, I think that's a good way to get talking about the visuals of this movie. Just in that I mentioned that's kind of the big moment. And so much of this movie is, you know, just slow and quiet. And
yeah, the score of this movie is like pretty much just piano, you know, like very slow, methodical piano. And that, I feel like that kind of sums up the way that the movie moves and, you know, kind of just exists. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I've just been reading a lot of people's opinions on this lately. And some people take that kind of understated, you know, construction of this movie differently. Some people say it's, you know, very utilitarian, and it's, you know, and I mean this, you know, the visuals, the music, as you mentioned, a lot of things about it are, you know, kind of just quieter, smaller, and meant to not get in the way of the subject matter in the story. And other people have called it just uninspired and bland and boring. And I want to get your opinion on that, and if that's kind of a tough line to walk of, you know, letting the subject matter be the star of the movie, or if there's a way to kind of be artful about that and still have still not detract from what is obviously a very powerful and emotional subject matter, no matter what you think of the execution of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think this movie is visually boring. And, you know, and I'm sure that I know that the idea that they were going for is exactly what you were describing. You know, it's like, we want to keep this, you know, grounded in reality. We don't want to do any flashy moves or anything. And, you know, we talked about it in an email a little bit. There are a couple moments that visually are good, you know, but there is just too much evidence that this movie doesn't have the capacity to think about better ways to do it, or more stylish ways to do it that can still be subtle. And certainly in Tom McCarthy's career, he has never really proven, you know, I've seen all of his movies except for the second half of The Station Agent, you know, like, and he's a utilitarian director. That's what it is, you know? And so, like, if you look at somebody like Darren Aronofsky, right? Like, The Wrestler, very utilitarianly directed film, you know? And that works, but it doesn't bother me because of the way that we've seen him direct The Fountain or Requiem for a Dream beforehand. You know, it's like, you know, he's got a variety of tools. Whereas with Tom McCarthy, I never really feel like he has the capacity to do something do something particularly interesting, you know? And yeah, there's the Dr. Sipe camera move, which is nice, the pull out from the speakerphone. But that there's a slight push in later that kind of ties into that move, but that's about it. And the rest of the movie is kind of like falls into the TV movie trap, you know, where it's just like a lot of walk and talks and a lot of shot reverse shot. And I just think that there is a mountain of evidence pointing to the fact that this, it was never possible for them to do anything more interesting just because of the lack of skills visually that Tom McCarthy has. I think I probably mentioned this to you when the nominations came out, that it's insane, because director is an award that I care a lot about, you know, given that I think it's the part of filmmaking I think the most about. I thought it was insane that Tom McCarthy got nominated for Best Director and Steven Spielberg didn't for Bridge of Spies, you know, because even if you look at these two movies side by side, both about true stories and, you know, in very different ways, and Bridge of Spies is a much, much, you know, spatially larger story. But just sort of the direction of them, Spielberg does a lot of interesting little things with the camera, and it's all very subtle, but it still sort of plays in the real world. But yeah, what I'm basically saying is that Tom McCarthy, I don't think he has the skills to do anything better, and that they're kind of just using this it's real life as a sort of excuse, you know?
Yeah, and I do get that. It's tough for me just because you have to have seen all those other movies, you know, to you know, see Spielberg's other movie, I guess it works better with your Darren Aronofsky example, to know that he has done these things and chose not to do them, whereas you've seen other Tom McCarthy movies and he's never shown himself capable of doing it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess it's just tough because you want to kind of look at a movie in a vacuum, and kind of, especially when giving awards or things like that. You know, maybe this is a bad year with Leo's Pity Oscar, if some people want to argue that, but we're supposed to look at these things in isolation. And to say that Darren Aronofsky doing something smaller is a great choice by him, whereas Tom McCarthy doing something smaller is evidence of his limitations. I think everything you're saying makes sense. I just, it's hard to negotiate those two ideas. Just kind of being so forgiving to one person and not the other if the product could be the exact same. And I know that there are things in The Wrestler that you do like visually.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we're looking on a shot-by-shot basis, the Wrestler's a better-looking movie than Spotlight as well. You know, even though it's just supposed – it's this grungy sort of handheld aesthetic. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, but I think you know what I'm getting at, of kind of having to take all of these things into account and – forgetting or criticizing based on things that have happened in the past, when mm-hmm. I don't think that's the way the awards work or film criticism works outside of the auteur lens.
Yeah, for sure. Well, okay, so let's take an isolated example, and this is going to be tricky because I don't think you've seen the film. Kenneth Lonergan is a director I enjoy a lot. He's only done two movies, but one of them was Margaret, which is one of my favorite movies of the last handful of years. Even though it was shot in 2006, it wasn't released until 2011. To call it utilitarian is like kind of being exceedingly polite to it, you know, like it's shot like a Kevin Smith mid-90s movie. Like, it's just really boring visually. I don't think he has the tools to do anything much better. I'm curious to see his new movie, which was kind of a Sundance sensation, but I think it's called Something by the Sea, I forget. But anyway, Casey Affleck's in it, Kyle Chandler's in it, I'm on board.
The Finest Hours,
maybe, I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, doesn't matter. Kenneth Lonergan. I can't wait. But
Chris Pine?
No, I don't think so. No. Oh, God. Chris Pine. Finest Hours. That's the boat movie.
Yeah. Okay.
Fuck you, man.
Light Between the Oceans.
Sure.
Okay.
let's just keep saying Bodies of Water.
Spotlight.
Yeah, exactly. Margaret, very visually boring movie, right? And but it, like there's something interesting that runs throughout that movie where there is a the way that they use sound in that movie, like whenever the characters are in a room where there are other people, there are so many distinct conversations going on that the movie straight up focuses on sometimes, even though we're not looking at these characters, like the audio sort of gravitates towards them. And this is something that I think was present on The Wire, the way that they used background sound. And it was just so interesting. And the idea of that, of Margaret, is that everybody has a story, and by adding these extra conversations in, it sort of ties that in. And I don't feel like there's something like that in Spotlight, you know? And I don't know, there's just something that just doesn't work, you know? And the way that the movie relies on walk and talks a lot to keep characters moving while also furthering the story is very television to me. And yeah, it's just, I mean, like, I feel like we'll just, if we keep talking about this, we'll just keep going around the bend in a certain walk and talk sort of style. But yeah, I don't think anybody's ever gonna convince me that this is a really well shot movie.
Okay.
Yeah. O'Toole theory or not.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard you say it a few times today, and I've heard it from a lot of other people that this is a glorified TV movie. Can you talk about what makes that? I mean, you've already mentioned the relatively straightforward shooting style. Is it just that?
It's that, and I mean, I was talking to Alistair about this a little bit, famed listener of the podcast, Alistair. And
subject matter too, right?
Yeah, subject matter a little bit, but it's just sort of, it is the way that it is shot, and also the fact that it's not a movie where I ever got riled up in any sort of way, right? It just sort of felt like...
Did you see the Mark Ruffalo yelling part?
You know what? That did kind of rile me up, but not in the way that the movie wanted me to be riled. Anyway, yeah, because I mean, I saw it at TIFF after that red carpet that I shot. But, you know, I watched it again for this, and I wanted to make sure to give it as much of a chance as I could because I didn't really like it at TIFF. And so I went out of my way to see it in the theater and all that, and made sure I could give it the best chance possible. And I did like it more than I liked it at TIFF. It's an entertaining movie, but it's also entertaining in the way that, you know, it comes on at 8 p.m. on, I mean, this is an old fashioned example because who watches a TV movie at 8 p.m. on a Sunday anymore, but like comes on at 8 p.m. on a Sunday, you watch it for a couple hours, and then on Monday you talk to somebody about it, and on Tuesday you kind of just done with it, you know? And that's how Spotlight sort of feels to me. And when we talked about it in the in our email conversation, I mentioned how it feels kind of like a 1990s movie in that way, in that in the 1990s there were a lot of these little dramas where, I mean, the one that's coming to mind right now for no reason at all is A Civil Action with John Travolta. I don't even know if that movie was good. I never saw it. But like that's sort of indicative of the type of movie that came out. You know, the legal thriller. There were tons of those throughout the 90s. And
good decade for Grisham.
Yeah, that guy cleaned up. Grisham and Clancy made a lot of money in the 90s. Obviously Clancy didn't make legal thrillers, but you know what I mean. Anyway, but the type of like drama that is set in a real world and is about adults and about adults working at their real life profession. And, it's not that big of a deal. Like this movie is just sort of a good example of what used to be the norm, you know? And I enjoy it. I enjoy that type of movie. You know, like I went through kind of like a 90s, I went through like some Wikipedia lists of 90s movies in specific genres that I just had never seen, and watched a bunch of them just because I kind of liked the way 90s filmmaking was. But it was, these all were all sort of one-off movies, and they're all enjoyable. Well, not all enjoyable, but you know, a lot of them are enjoyable, but also really forgettable. And I feel like
it didn't win Best Picture.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, even removed from the Best Picture conversation, like Spotlight is one of those movies, and that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it yesterday more than I expected to, because I enjoyed it yesterday. But that's pretty much it. You know, like it's enjoyable to watch, and there are some good moments, and It's a very hard movie to hate, for sure. Once you get past my certain directorial biases. But yeah, it was just sort of, it was a movie I watched and definitely liked for 2 hours and 9 minutes. But outside of that, that's fine. You know, like, that's kind of the limit. Had it been 2 hours and 10 minutes, I might have checked out.
Yeah, right. You didn't read all the names of the cities, I guess, is where we lost you. Eh?
Oh, no, I was my eyes were in the back of my head for that part.
Oh, why?
Just rolling. I don't know. I always, those text things at the end are always so tricky. And I don't know, when I saw it at TIFF, people were like gasping, you know, and like seeing things at a film festival. And I hate to harp on this, but it's always weird. Because you never get an accurate perception of how the movie's going to be received. And especially with, I think, with a real life story, everybody is afraid to not like it, especially about something important, you know. And
yeah, something so heavy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody wants to be in a room with 1,250 strangers and not be the person to like Spotlight, you know. You know, even me, I was off to the side in like a little cubby, you know, I didn't have to sit amongst the people, you know, so I was allowed to complain about it and nobody would hear. So, but yeah, it was just, it was a really weird experience. And then the journalists came out on stage and got a huge standing ovation, which I have no qualms with, certainly. But, I think transferring what the real people did with the to the movie itself, I think is a little problematic, you know, or giving it too much credit. But anyway, the text roll at the end kind of bugged me.
Okay, so when you were talking about how it's kind of just this one-off, you know, forgettable kind of 90s adult thing, I just feel like there's a way to describe this movie to you on paper that it makes it sound like a movie that you would really, really like.
Unquestionably.
You know, it's got, coincidentally enough, with Tom McCarthy, like kind of a Fifth Season Wire vibe.
No,
I mentioned that because he wasn't an actor in The Wire, for anyone who doesn't know that.
Yeah, he played Scott Templeton.
Yeah, who was a very morally dubious journalist, unlike the way
I got to say it again. The Pulitzer Prize winning Scott Templeton.
Okay.
Yeah. But yes, as you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's got this, you know, Fifth Season Wire vibe, like very... very true to life, you know, the way that when we talked about that in The Wire, people would say that that was the most accurate portrayal of a like a newspaper office that they had ever seen, that the relationships between the writers and editors and things like that were very good and very real, that the lingo was all spot on. And my understanding of this is that it was extremely similar, that this was a very accurate representation, not just of the way that, not just the facts of the case, but the way that departments like this would function, and the way that the Boston Globe functioned at the time. And, you know, a lot of the real people have said how similar or how surreal it is to see someone doing, you know, almost exactly what you did. So it's got this very realistic, dry, true to nature, true to reality nature about it. It's a movie about, you know, going after the institution instead of the individual, which is something that is spelled out pretty clearly here. It's something that I think is also true of The Wire. And I think one of the things that made that kind of a next level piece of entertainment, kind of a piece of art. It's a movie that seems to be very interested in emulating a lot of those good 70s journalism movies, like All the President's Men is a name that comes up a lot, a movie that I know you like.
A movie I love.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It's a movie, you know, for adults, you know, not just in the sense of gratuitous violence and sexuality, but, you know, just playing for adults and not teenagers, and certainly not for children. There's no extra bullshit. There's no love story. There's no sex scene. There's no chase scene just to, you know, keep people interested, engaged. I feel like there's just a checklist of good things here that tailor so well towards you. And this just seems to have failed to really coalesce into something more than the sum of its parts. And I want to know where you think that it it missed it.
Well, I don't know. Because, yeah, to touch on one of your points, as a general rule, if your movie is about the media pretty much in any capacity, I'm probably going to love it. Or, be really interested in it, especially if there is at any point a newsroom involved, you know, like television or newspaper, whatever. You know, I've just, even as a kid, I remember being fascinated by movies about the media in any way. And yeah, so that was something that I would certainly have expected to like more about this movie. And I don't remember how I was feeling about this movie before I saw it, like how much I expected to like it or anything. But anyway, and like, to make it clear, I do like this movie. But you know, with the sort of, in the sort of way that I've described it, I really enjoyed it to watch and then I'm done with it, you know?
Yeah.
But
that's not the case of so many of those other 70s movies that,
yeah,
this kind of gets lumped in with.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if you look at the 70s movies, if you were to watch All the President's Men and and of course, comparing Spotlight to All the President's Men, comparing most movies to All the President's Men is very unfair to Spotlight or that other movie, because All the President's Men is a lot of talented people operating at the highest point that they would ever operate at, you know? And that's great. And like, even just looking at Alan Pakula's career, he also made Clute and The Parallax View, which are both very good. The Parallax View is awesome, and dealing with the same sort of thing. And I think both of those movies fall into the sort of category that you're describing, and are just so much more artful, I think. But like, yeah, I don't know. There's just something about Spotlight that doesn't work for me. I think there's a lot of simultaneous showing and telling in this movie that kind of drives me crazy. In that,
oh boy, how about the? Oh, of course, there's a church and there's a playground. Oh boy!
And you know what the worst part of that is? If that was just a shot, if that was a shot, and he doesn't say that line, that's a good shot. You know.
Yeah. And they kind of half-ass another one of those later on.
Oh yeah, for sure. And as far as the repetition goes, I mean, I asked you this, but there's a lot of dialogue that like somebody says something, and then one of the Spotlight people is like, "Oh, so you mean this?" And I understand that is part of journalism, and I get it. But there's a lot of things in the movie that sort of lead me to think that, like that church in the playground shot and line that lead me to believe that it would have been in there even if not for journalistic integrity, you know, where it's just kind of talking to the audience. And the way that I forget his name, but Brian D'Arcy James, his character, the not famous person in Spotlight, like actor in Spotlight, how he goes to that house that's nearby, and you know, in a montage later, there's a shot of it, and then at the end, he drops the paper on the doorstep. I mean, that's just like, that's hitting you over the head in a way that I despise, you know, and in a way that those other movies that I feel like get lumped into the same category as Spotlight just don't do, you know?
Yeah, and yeah, you're right. I think that one especially, that one hurt me to watch. I mean,
it wasn't just your sickness taking over?
No, and I know, I mean, it's something I know that you wouldn't like either, but just that is the worst example. I mean, maybe not the worst example in this movie, but
no, the worst is the church on the playground line, and then that's a close second.
Yeah, and again, it's not, you know, as you said about if that was just a visual thing, there's a way to kind of address that and a way to handle that isn't so heavy-handed. And the note on the fridge, and that was, I just couldn't wait for that little section to be over.
See, the note on the fridge I'm fine with, because it kind of is like, there's an occasional laugh line in this movie, and that was kind of one of those. But at least the way that people reacted to it both times I saw it. So, I mean, there are parts of this movie that I laughed at that I don't think I'm supposed to, like the way Rachel McAdams reacts to when she finds the copy, the 20-year-old old copy, and gives it to Michael Keaton or Robbie, and then they cut back to Sasha, and the face that she's making is just so funny to me. And yeah, it, anyway, that makes me laugh. But yeah, there, that is a laugh, I think, intentionally. And, but at that point, after drawing so much attention to it, you could never go back to that house, you know?
Yeah.
And then they do two more times, at least. Oh, three more times, because he asks Robbie about it.
I didn't enjoy that part at all.
Yeah.
Sorry,
oh, just ahead. One more quick thing about newsrooms, sure. And how I was concerned about this movie right off the bat. The first scene of this movie in the newsroom, I just, with the former editor retiring, I just felt like, I don't know, that scene felt so forced, and like nobody was natural in that scene. I don't know, it just felt like forced camaraderie, and I didn't like it at all. And I think that really sets the movie off on the wrong foot, you know?
Yeah, I didn't really love Michael Keaton in this, even though it hurts me to say that.
A lot of things are hurting you about this movie.
Very sensitive. Let's talk about Marty then, if we're going to look at some characters.
Sure.
Liev Schreiber. Marty
right. Baron? That is correct.
Yep. This was kind of one of the most, I think, dynamic parts of this movie, at least for me.
Absolutely. If we're looking at characters and character arcs throughout this movie, or the way that certain facets of the newspaper industry are portrayed, I think Marty Baron is the most interesting part, for sure.
Okay. So what did you find interesting about him?
Well, so if we look at... and I mean, I mean that Marty Baron is just the most interesting part of this movie, the way that he's characterized, you know?
Right.
And the reason I say that is because we have been conditioned over a decade plus of watching movies about journalism, about how papers are always being cut, you know, like there are cuts coming, you know, the yeah. internet's taken over, all that stuff. And that's certainly a part of this movie, given that this movie takes place in 2001.
Yeah. And I found they didn't lean too hard on the internet thing, but we'll talk about that.
No. Yeah. But the way that it's established is that there's this new editor coming in, right?
Yeah.
And why is this new editor coming in? Well, it's probably to make some tough decisions. Oh, did you hear about what he did in Florida? You know, he kind of
cut 15% of his left of the staff at his other job. Yeah,
exactly. And the way that we have been instructed to view characters like Marty Baron through, you know, years and years of watching movies, is to think that he is going to be the villain. And he's not, you know, he's kind of he is very not forceful, that's too strong of a word, but you know, he's the way that he thinks is the way that things should run, but the way that he thinks is actually kind of in line with journalists, you know, whereas in so many other movies about journalists, we see the person that has to deal with the bottom line as somebody that has to see the bottom line and doesn't necessarily see the journalism that goes on above it, you know. And he's portrayed as somebody that cares about the journalism and about making sure Spotlight has the story right and that the story is big enough. I mean, he's the guy that says go after the system, right?
Yeah.
And I just found that really interesting, you know, and just because in the way that this movie does things a lot of the time in the way that so many movies have done it before, that's the thing that it did in a way that I hadn't seen before, you know, like even, I mean, we talked about season 5 of The Wire, Gus in that season, the person above him is, I forget his name, but it's Gale from The Wire, is just constantly trying to take away his money, you know, trying to help make it harder for him to do journalism, basically, to run his newsroom.
Yeah.
And that's the character that Liev Schreiber would be playing in season 5 of The Wire, if we were to put a Marty Baron equivalent into it.
Yeah.
And Marty Baron doesn't do those things. You know, he's surveying the landscape for sure. And I would imagine some jobs got cut, but not in Spotlight, you know, because he views Spotlight as important. You know?
Yeah, no, so I think you're right. And I think that the way that it, as you said, it always is, we have the new... editor come in, or the new boss if it's not a newspaper. Yeah,
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the media environment.
It's certainly applicable in the media thing, because there's this newspaper especially, there is this kind of intangible thing. I mean, if you're, you know, making whatever cups, it's about how many cups you could make. You know, it's, you can hire this many people, we can make cups, there you go. Whereas there is kind of this, you know, harder to nail down function of the media about actually enlightening people, maybe making a difference in the world by highlighting these sexual abuses and how high up it goes, and maybe there'll be some change in all the way up to the Vatican because of what we've done here today, kind of thing. So it really applies here, but it's not just that he's the new boss and that he's got this a reputation of, you know, cutting costs and firing people and slashing jobs and all these things. He's kind of standoffish. You know, it's really hard to read him at the beginning, but he's certainly not buddying up to anybody.
No.
He's as respectful as he needs to be, but, you know, he's at no part of this movie is he a warm character, you know?
No, he seems like somebody that believes in a defined line between boss and employees.
Yeah, and not losing poker money to me at the table,
exactly.
Is going on in that first scene.
cake. I don't need cake at those things. It depresses me. I should bring it to the house across the street. They're good people.
So depressed.
Oh, wait, they're not good people. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So there's, I mean, all those kind of obvious things that you talked about. Everything you say to me is obvious. no, but then we also get at that dinner scene where he's, you know, reading a book about Babe Ruth or
The Curse of the Bambino.
You know, yeah. And of course, he gets invited to the baseball game and he reveals he's not a baseball fan. So it's, as he explains, kind of just more of an attempt to understand the people here.
Didn't like what steroids did to the game.
Sure.
It's 2001. We're at the height of that. Sorry.
Continue. Okay, that's true. No, there's just kind of he's kind of just this alien. He's here to understand how these people work. He's not one of them, but he's going to read some of their texts to gain insight to them, to, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he doesn't like baseball, and he's in Boston and he doesn't like baseball, you know. He does all these things that set you up to hate him. And then, you know, as the movie continues and we see that he's not making cuts to Spotlight, which, you know, just to briefly touch on the internet thing, Spotlight is the antithesis of what is coming to bring this newspaper industry down, right?
Yeah.
It's the anti-BuzzFeed. It's the, let's take several months to write one story.
Let's take a year. They specifically say over a year is how long they work on stories.
Exactly. Let's work for this long on a story just to make sure we can properly report everything. It's not what the internet does. It's what, you know, proper investigative newspaper journalism was. Ideally, too, right? Not just a newspaper, but the most newspapery part of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the essence of it. And he says, we'll hold on to this story. We'll keep going. We want to make sure we get it right. Let's make sure we get the institution and not just the individuals. And he out Spotlight. I mean, it's crazy what he does. Spotlight. and it's such a good, it's not really a curveball, and it's, but I think it's more than just,
I see what you did there. Baseball terminology to a guy that doesn't like baseball. Continue.
There you go. But it's more than just, you know, people can't be judged by the cover, and even if you flip to their Spotlight section and read it, you can't fully understand them. It's, you know, that's what I mean when I say this is kind of the most dynamic part of this movie to me, is that this seems like one more extremely stereotypical character in this movie that writes, in my opinion, some pretty stereotypical characters and scenes. Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting part. And you can't quite ever get a grasp on him. Even by the end, when you see that he's a good guy, there's still not that moment at the end when he kind of lets his guard down and says, look, I've been one of you all along, even though I'm, you know, not from Boston. And yeah. So many of you guys are from Boston. And that's what you say makes it feel like a local paper. And he's Jewish. And this, you know, Boston is this famously Catholic city. And it gets talked about how important the churches and the priests and the cardinals and the bishops in this area are. And, you know, it's just one other way that he's an outsider on this. And just the fact that it wasn't a facade that he puts up until he kind of passes the test and becomes one of them. And then he plays golf with them and plays poker with them and goes to baseball games. And he's just not really fully let in. Not that they don't like him, but it's more true to life. This is his personality, and this is who he is, and this was his upbringing. And even an experience as powerful as what these journalists must have went through doesn't completely simplify everything and take down every barrier. And I thought that was something kind of lost in this movie that I don't hear people talk about, that is actually probably one of the most successful parts of this movie for me.
I agree entirely.
Okay.
Yeah, and the reason, like, we never, and it's great that the movie holds back on, you know, him being like, yeah, Robbie, let's go golf and then go play poker and do all those things that you used to do with.
Suck on some chili dogs down by the Tasty Fruit.
Yeah, let's go do all of those things because we're friends now. Because he, like, going with the way that he's been characterized throughout the movie, he knows that once this story is out, there's still more work to be done. Not even just on this story, but like he knows that he has to maintain that boss employee relationship with the people of Spotlight for the next Spotlight story, you know? Yeah. And I think it's smart that the movie never folds on that one, that idea that they keep up the Marty Baron thing. And even though there's, I think, probably like a half hour to 40 minute section of this movie that he's not in at all, I just found him to be the most interesting part of the movie.
Yeah, oh, 100%.
Yeah, because of all of the reasons that we've talked about.
Yeah, and we've kind of been saying how it does really kind of, other than just what we spoke about, but because that's such a juxtaposition, that this does really fall into so many conventions. Were you surprised you didn't hear more about the internet in this? Because as you said, it's 2001, it is pretty relevant. We didn't kind of have that character, which I guess is who Marty is replacing, telling people to spend less time on things and to hurry things up and to, you know, make it flashier and keep pounding on the table about ad revenues and things like that.
Yeah, I think the way that the movie treated that, I think, is right. Because one of the things about the newspaper industry is that, yeah, by 2001, the internet is very prevalent, but the newspaper industry still wasn't terrified of it yet, you know? And I think it's good that they didn't hit the internet thing over the head. Like, they were starting to worry, and we get those sort of starting to worry concerns from Marty in his meeting with Robbie at the beginning of their dinner, where they start to, or where he mentions, you know, the internet's killing classified revenue and stuff like that. Like, these are things that are starting to notice, but are not like crippling them yet, you know?
Right.
And I think the movie just takes place just slightly too long ago to have really hit the internet thing without it being wrong, you know, timing wise.
Yeah. And I think that in looking back on it, you could kind of plug some more of that stuff in there, even if it was anachronistic. And I think it was right of them not to.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think what the movie, in keeping with the sort of what we were talking about with the way that the movie shot, the movie just shows journalism as important by showing journalism, you know? And so they had to leave all the frills out. And the frills are changing the timeline a little bit to make the Globe afraid of the internet earlier, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And this does function as a pretty big love letter to kind of newspaper and investigative journalism, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's the heartwarming part of this to me is the, I don't know. I mean, you and I are probably on the same page as this. We both enjoy the idea that journalism does good things, that writers are able to do good things by researching the world and all that stuff. And that's something, I mean, that ties into my love of anything about the media in general, is that I enjoy the idea of reporting, and specifically the idea of good reporting. And yeah, it is very much a love letter to journalism.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I was right about something. Yeah.
Check that off the checklist.
It's a long list.
Not if I have anything to say about it. Pass it over to me with my red pen.
Right.
Yeah.
Your Marty Baron editor pen.
Yep. That's right.
Yep.
Got anything more on Spotlight?
Not really.
Do you want to talk about the Oscar ceremony a little bit?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any large thoughts about it, but I feel like the people need our opinions, you know? People have been clamoring.
So much clamoring.
If we give them just a 50-minute episode, they're going to be furious.
Everyone always says your episodes are way too short.
Yeah, that's definitely our... The audience is number one concerned with this. It's definitely not my roommate constantly telling me, God, your episodes are so long. That is definitely not something that happens. So, I mean, we watched the Oscars together. You would know I was lying if I said I didn't enjoy Chris Rock. You know, yeah. I thought he was great. And as we talked about that night, like, he was just swinging for the fences pretty much constantly. And some of it didn't work. But sometimes you get Suge Knight sitting on a throne of Girl Guide cookies. And I think, like, I love people that are able to do something on that stage that is like they have the confidence to fail, and also the balls to fail, and also the confidence and balls to try something. Like, his monologue was so dark, you know, like,
yeah,
like I think
the
I
words
said,
rape and lynch.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was the one of the things I said to you. It's like, that's probably the first time there's been a lynching joke in an Oscars monologue. And yeah, I don't know. I thought it was really fascinating to watch, and I was laughing a lot, which was nice. And I don't know. I've seen some people complain about it, and I was just like, what the hell is wrong with you? How, like, if we're never going to get, I mean, again, as I said, I don't think about the Oscars all that much after they're over. But I think this year was kind of the exception. And in trying to think back, about Oscar ceremonies I've watched, like, I just can't think of one that I enjoyed more than this, even though I didn't care about very many of the awards. You know, I didn't have a lot invested in the winners, because a lot of the awards that I did care about, I mean, it was like Emmanuel Lubezki was clearly going to win for The Revenant, you know, like that type of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny. I mean, we all knew there was going to be a lot of discussion about the racial makeup of the nominees.
Yeah.
And I think they did even more than I thought they were going to do, mm-hmm. to be honest. Like, mm-hmm. Some of the bits, the pre-recorded stuff, which, you know, normally is more about the nature of the movies than, you know, the biggest kind of talking point about the ceremony.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Tracy Morgan still was the Danish girl. You know?
See, that's really funny.
It's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was good. I thought they did a lot of that, and I didn't kind of really grow tired of it. And I thought, as he tends to do, Louis C.K. being very honest and taking the whole ceremony down a peg, discussing about the best documentary short, going home in a Honda Civic and things like that. I thought that was really good. And I always, you know, kind of like people taking the piss out of it a little bit, because it's so so hoity-toity and so self-congratulatory that it's nice to kind of be reminded that even in this context, there are some, I don't know, not one percenters.
yeah, exactly. I mean, in that bit, which I also loved and really killed in the ceremony, you know, which I think is not something that we can say for a lot of Chris Rock stuff. Like, I think if I were to watch his monologue back and try not to laugh, I think it's a lot of dead air in that room. Which is something I also really liked about Chris Rock, was that he played to us instead of the people in in the theater. But one of the things Louis C.K. says is, "You came here millionaires, you came here winners, and you're leaving millionaires." You know, which I think is speaks to exactly what you're talking about. You know, taking the whole thing down a peg.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I'd mentioned the kind of the way that Spotlight was, you know, an issue movie, both in the sexual assault scandal, sexual abuse, whatever you want to call it, and also just investigative journalism and newspapers in general, tying into the media. We had Birdman win Best Picture last year, and you know, obviously about Michael Keaton's character / Michael Keaton making his career comeback.
Yeah.
And in a very, you know, showing acting is kind of this crazy world, but still very noble, and showing it, I think, in a positive light, even when some bad things happened. And Mike Singer, Edward Norton's character, not always being shown as a, you know, a very nice guy. I think he's still kind of get left with this feeling that it's very important.
The idea of Birdman is to try hard enough at your art to be able to transcend, you know, like that's the end of the movie, right?
We can draw a pretty short line from that to The Revenant this year.
Yeah. Even though Michael Keaton was kind of Jack Norris and hopping from one championship team to the next, you know? But yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, just Birdman being pretty, you know, pro actor, the artist a few years ago being very kind of pro Hollywood, even more historical sense. Argo more recently celebrating filmmakers, is all that kind of an unfair telling of the recent self-congratulatory history of the Oscars, or do you think that that's applicable?
No, I think that that makes sense. It's something I hadn't thought about, but I do think you are right. At least, if not, I don't think it's a bunch of Academy members, you know, sitting around at a book club or their version of a book club talking about screeners that are like, yeah, we should award this profession this year, you know, like. But I do think that is certainly a trend that we are seeing throughout our analytics processes, you know. I think you're right.
Oscar metrics.
Yeah.
Actually, wait. Spotlight.
Yeah. Spotlight metrics. Let's put a spotlight on these metrics.
I think that's all I got for Spotlight. Spotlight.
Okay. Well, let's turn the spotlight over to whatever podcast you've got on deck. Another baseball reference for Marty. Thank you for listening to the McGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themcguffinmen.com, and also be sure to spotlight. Music hitting your heart, cause I know you got a soul. Hey, listen, if you're missing, y'all, swinging while I'm singing. Hey, giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need. Hey, our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power. As the rhythm's designed to bounce with calcium, that's the rhyme. Designed to fill your mind now that you realize the prize arrives. We got to pump the stuff to make it tough. From the heart, it's a start, a work of art to revolutionize, make a change, something strange. People, people, we are the same. No, we're not the same, cause we don't know the game. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless. You say, what is this? Yeah. Our beloved, let's get down to business. Mental self-defense of fitness. Don't rest the show. You got to throw the punch, you know. To make everybody see. In order to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
the power. Fight 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 the power. We got to fight the power.
Check. Don't worry, be happy.
Was a number one jam. Damn if I said you could slap me right here. Get it.
Let's